Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST. Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, my name's Sam Moores. Welcome to the Car Chat podcast. And with us today, we have Richard Tuttle. Hello.
Good morning. Hello. Thanks for having
me. Good morning. Can you tell the audience a little bit about sort of who you are and what you do?
Certainly. So I'm Richard Tuttle, and I'm sat here in our lovely workshop surrounded by Porsches. And we, for the last 40-something years, I suspect, have been building, preparing, and charging around the world with Porsches. My father started the business. We are fully committed to everything Porsche.
Everything Porsche. And predominantly 911? Or have there been some others, non-911s, along the way?
Look, yes, ultimately, on any given day, 99% of the cars in the workshop will be 911s. Of course, we have some 356 heritage, so we've restored a couple of Roadsters and Speedsters as of late. But yes, primarily, 911's the one.
Yeah. So take me back. How did this sort of begin? You said your father started the business, but your journey into it, and also, I guess, the start a little bit of the business. Where did it begin?
Very briefly, that can't start this off without mentioning the old man, but he was a farmer, went to Australia, there was a drought, got a job as a VW mechanic, came back as a mechanic, started a business, did some rallying, did London to Sydney in 77 in a Beetle,
Hang on, sorry, stop for a second. London to Sydney?
Yeah, that's a long way, isn't it?
That is a long way.
Yeah, he's done that three times. He won it in 1993. A slightly easier trip, I imagine, than in the Beetle. I don't think they didn't book a hotel between London and Sydney because they never got to the hotels in time. So it's just, they had curtains in the Beetle. They had curtains in the car and they slept pretty much all the way in the car. So they finished. There's a great picture of him lying on a rug that we still have in the house. In Sydney. So no, amazing story. But by the way, he'd never done any rallying up until that point. He wrote to VW and said, how do I do this? And they sent him a manual. Good story.
Amazing.
But I think funny enough, that spirit is still in the building. I grew up with it. And our attitude, wherever we are in the world, whether it's on a racetrack or whether we're in Kenya, is everything's possible. So, you know, let's just crack on and make it happen.
Mm. And then, so he started this business. And you, I guess, were around cars, presumably, as a little person, seeing all this stuff going on.
I was born 50 meters from where I sit. Dad moved here when he was 17. I've never lived anywhere else. I've got an elder brother, a younger sister. My brother, bless him, I've got pictures of him in these workshops. from a very young age. He was sent on the Granite City Rally with the mechanics when he was three. I mean, no wonder he hates cars. And I mean, absolutely, he can't even fill them up with fuel. So I was lucky. He took the hit. I had an interest in them, and obviously probably was sheltered from my father's craziness. But no, it's been a thing. And we're lucky we live in the countryside. I rolled my first VW Beetle in the field up here when I was eight or nine. I had no chance. I was in for the long haul, but I didn't come straight here, actually. It took me a while to get here.
So where did you go on route?
I started as a gardener at ProDrive, the world-famous engineering company, Subaru World Rally Team, all of that stuff. So I started as a gardener at 12. I wasn't great at school, so I got kicked out. So I then built a few sheds on a farm, welding and all sorts of things. I worked on a few Datsuns with a mate. And eventually then actually ProDrive supported me through university. I did some driving with them. I was a technician on world championship events with them. So I had a good grounding. But finally, I was driving in America at the time, an American rally championship, and that came to an end. And the old man said, can I come and help him for one rally? Which ironically was the 2003 Safari Rally. So that was my first official, okay, I'm going to come and help the old man.
Mm.
And now look.
Not left. So up until that point, were you doing some racing and stuff, or were you just working and
I won the British Junior Rally Championship in 96 driving a Vauxhall Nova. Nice. I finished second in the Production Cup British Championship in a Subaru in 99, probably. Did a few World Championship rallies with Subaru. I then drove in America with Mitsubishi and then had one outing with Hyundai. Ultimately, I didn't get there. Lots of reasons why, and ifs and buts, but that's how life is. And at a certain point, I decided I was either going to do something in the only way possible, which is fully committed, or I wasn't going to do it at all, so I stopped driving.
Yeah.
I'm hugely passionate about buildings, commercial and residential. So I was restoring houses and having a great time. Then, as I say, the old man said, come and help. And I never left.
So you went off to Africa.
Yeah.
What did the operation look like back then? Cause I imagine it's actually changed quite a bit.
Yeah, it's changed beyond recognition, actually. And the biggest single change is the new building we moved into 3 years ago. But the operation in 2003 was five cars, which was still a significant number of cars. We become blasé about what we do these days, but five cars were serious. I was a co-driver in one car. I have learned my lesson now, finally. I've co-driven for some great people, Voldegaard, Jimmy McRae, Stuart and I finished third in that rally. Chris Harris and I did a rally for M Sport, which was a shambles, but we won our class. And I co-drove for Martin Rowe on the Trans-Siberia Rally with Porsche. And I can officially confirm that it will never happen again. Every time I do, I think, why the hell am I here? But there we are. So no, I was co-driving in Africa. And as I say, Stuart and I finished third. Stuart was... has since been the chairman of the BRDC. He's a wonderful man, lives 15 miles away. And we had an amazing adventure. And yes, he knows at times I really didn't enjoy myself. And we had some proper proper moments where I was trying to slow him down because we were in a great position. He was swearing at me because he reckoned his granny could drive faster and she probably could have done. But there comes a time in the Safari Rally where you are and you can't beat anyone in front of you on pace. You can lose an amazing podium position. Right. So we got there, and I've got an amazing, amazing memory with Stuart, and it was a brilliant result on the podium. So that year we finished second and third. Good start.
How does driving in an event like that compare to other rallies or types of driving? In terms of like, you know, how fast are you going in terms of looking after the car versus navigating, and what does it look like?
I think so. There could be a perception that it's all about survival and endurance. That's wrong. It's not a sprint rally, but it's close to, actually. If you look at the drivers who were driving then and now, we've just come back with Ken Block driving for us. Patrick Sandell, a Formula Junior World Rally champion. These boys are quick. So yes, the car has to look after itself. We have to look after the car, but it's an out and out competition sprint rally. Endurance has semi disappeared in rallying, full stop. Dakar, they have amazingly long stages, but make no mistake, all of these categories in rallying, they're on it. The margins are fine, and you have to have a bit of luck to win. You have to have a very, very clean run mechanically and as a driver. So the beauty about Africa, if I was to take you today to Wales and chuck you in a Welsh forest, let's say it was wet, you've got to deal with poor vision, as in you can't see very far down the road because you've got trees all around you. You've got camber, crests, mud, gravel. You've got all of this stuff. In Kenya, there's a whole load of reasons why it's easier. There's a whole load of reasons why it's not as easy. But on the whole, I can take novice drivers to Africa in a good car with good co-drivers and expect them to perform really, really well. It allows you that opportunity.
And what's the difference? Is it you can see more? It's like the opposite of all of those things.
Yeah.
Conditions are similar.
You can see a lot further. The roads are less technical in the sense that there's less cambers and jumps and hidden stuff. It's a little bit more technical in terms of you've got some incredibly rough sections, you've got washouts, you've got all of this stuff. So it's a bit of a generalization, but put it this way, we have finished in the top 10 with novice drivers multiple times, 10, 20 times in the last 10 safari rallies. And if I took someone to a UK rally or let's say Rally GB or whatever, there's absolutely no chance you can finish in the top 10 because the pace is so fast and it's so technical. And the only way you can get to that speed is years of driving.
Yeah. Well, that must also say a lot about the co-drivers and the support and the cars and all of that, that you can get someone through.
So you're right. And my job with Stuart and the job that I ask professional co-drivers to do for our clients is we've got to manage them. We've got to manage their expectation. And if you bolt yourself next to it. So I always had an analogy when I was driving. If I could take a good co-driver or a brand new set of tires, I'd always take a good co-driver. I mean, ideally you'd have both, but if you had to make a choice. And the ability, so this year, lovely client, Raymond Voss, done some GT driving. He sat next to Stefan Prevot, or should I say Stefan Prevot sat next to him. Stefan is the most experienced WRC co-driver of all time. Okay, so he's driven with world champions. He's all he's done for the last 30 years of his life is sit next to people. You bolt him in your car, you concentrate on driving. Stefan manages everything else. It's just a world of difference. They're incredible people. And as I've already said, I never want to be one again.
Do you have to, with someone like that, do you have to sort of like coax them in? You're like, we've got this new person, but they're great. They're a really nice guy. Yeah. They'll listen to you.
Yeah, you tell them all that bullshit, and then with a bit of luck, some of it happens. But no, listen, I've known Stefan for a long time, and we have a network of great co-drivers, great driver coaches, and thankfully we genuinely have great clients. So they're a reasonable bunch. But if you then speak to, and I'll get shot for saying this, but if you then speak to Ryan Champion, who sits next to Philip Cadori, Philip doesn't always toe the line, let's say. He's a quick driver and he's very, very brave. So, I wouldn't envy that job.
And what sort of thing is the co-driver is obviously doing some navigating. You've got to go that direction, etc. And if they're super experienced, presumably pretty on top of most of that. And then are they saying like they're doing some coaching at the same time?
Yeah, again, because Safari doesn't have pace notes, it has tulip notes. So, in fact, this year for the first time they had GPS as well, which is a bit of cop out. So there's actually, yes, pure navigation. Are we going left, right? And when are we going left or right? Or what's the road condition? Because some of the bumps are marked, some of the jumps are marked, that type of stuff. But it is essentially a blind rally. So you have to always take that with a pinch of salt. And then depending on the co-driver, and depending on the driver, they either will accept a bit of guidance and they can absorb it, or they can't. And that's something that over a 10-day rally, then you're gonna build a relationship and you're gonna get it right. But as I say, some drivers want coaching, some drivers need it, others may need it but they don't want it. It's a world of opportunity, but it works. It's very, very well proven now that we can match the right driver with the right co-driver and they can have a great time.
And the process of adapting to driving off-road from someone, I imagine a typical entrance point to this would be you might get someone that's done a bunch of GT driving. I know quite a few people that have done a bunch of GT racing that have then come across and done some rallying. I think actually with you guys, also Philip is an example. Who else did I have? Eugenio Amos, did he race with you guys?
It was funny. Nothing to do with this conversation, but I saw one of his lovely cars yesterday. One of our clients drove into the workshop in one of his lovely Integrale. So what a cool thing. Nice. Eugenio's perfect. In fact, he's now completely, before he came in one of our cars, he'd done some cross-country stuff, and I know he did a whole world championship last year with a view to doing Dakar. COVID beat him to it, so that was a bloody shame. But no, look, in a funny way, I've now, as a company, we're doing more racing than rallying more regularly. Mm. And I've been doing some racing. Terrifying. And but what I can absolutely say is racing helps your rallying because it tidies you up. Rallying also helps your racing because you understand what a car feels like when it's on the limit. So there's a very, very strong correlation, which may not be obvious, but I'd still say easier to go from rallying to racing than racing to rallying.
Mm. Do you have to? Yeah, you often get people when they talk about like drifting or something. Racing drivers talking about trying to drift, and they're like, "I can't do it because I have to unlearn so much stuff." And
why would you? Why would you have slip angle in a car? That's a pretty common thought. Yeah.
Get rid of it and carry on.
However, I mean, you look at F1 cars. The cars are moving a little bit. I mean.
Yeah.
And then if you look at MotoGP, nothing to do with cars again, those guys back the bikes into corners. So there's a piece, obviously, about looking after your tyres. There's a piece about extracting the most out of it. But, of course, even in rallying, straightest is fastest.
Mm.
Dull, really, but there we are.
I've done a tiny bit of, and I wouldn't even call it rallying, like I did a morning in an Escort at somewhere near Silverstone.
Bill Gwynn's, very small, I hope. Bill Gwynn's rally school?
No, it was a different one. It was very near, I can't remember what it's called. It wasn't that. It was like Silverstone, the Silverstone rally school or something.
Anyway, Escort and rally school is a good combo.
Yeah, and we had some brief sort of discussions before getting in the car, and it was like the first thing was like, well, why do people, and this just kind of confused my mind. He was like, well, why would you might want to put angle on a car going into a corner? And I was like, well, it looks cool. Who doesn't want to skid? Might help you get around the corner, all this stuff. And then, and the sort of message came back was like, well, actually a lot of it is vision.
Yeah. Yeah.
Being able to see. And if you can't, because if you can't see, you can't put your foot down.
Rally drivers. So again, there's two forms of rallying. I mean, lots of forms of rallying, but there's a style you will employ with pace notes. So if you look at the current WRC drivers, they've got pace notes. They're very, very accurate. They absolutely trust in them, and they're driving to the limit. And those cars are becoming more like race cars. I mean, they've got huge downforce now in the last couple of seasons that they never used to have. Well, downforce clearly tells you one thing. They want the car to be straight because, okay, well, a world rally car can cope with some angle and the downforce will still be there to a certain extent. But if you're driving blind, then absolutely you need to have the car floating, because if you come up to a blind corner, well, does it tighten? Does it open? What's happening? And if you've got a car already moving, then you can change its attitude very, very quickly with a throttle input, a brake input, possibly left foot braking, which is something that's very common in rallying. So if you've got a car glued to the road and you need to make it change direction very, very quickly, you've got to unstick it first.
Yeah.
But I think the principles of rallying have changed. And if you put a modern driver in an old car now, racing or rallying, actually, historic racing or rallying, then they still want to make the car go straight. And they're right. It is the quickest way. But there's lots of reasons why we drive like we do. And it will depend very much on the surface, on the information you have in front of you. And of course, the objective sideways is still a lot of fun.
Yeah. And so you've driven these cars, I mean, extensively off-road, let's say old 911s and a variety of stuff. Was it interesting starting to do more track driving and having to change, you have to change your driving style and how the cars are sort of set, obviously they're set up differently, but, you know, has that been an interesting learning experience of then like what's fast on track?
It's been really, really interesting. And I don't know who in the world will have driven a 911 more than me off-road. I genuinely don't, because I spend and have spent hours behind the wheel. And you become a little bit typecast because a 911 is a 911. So if you put me in a BMW, I'm a little bit confused. So it is pretty much the polar opposite. Now, it's interesting because my last bit of driving I did when I was a driver, it was all four-wheel drive, and a 911 is funnily similar to a four-wheel drive car. But then if you go circuit racing, and bear in mind, I'm always talking historic stuff. I haven't, but I will get myself into a 992 Cup car on a track soon, because I'm really interested in that. But if I talk about historic circuit racing, which is what we tend to do most of the time, we have tyres that don't provide you with a much support. I mean, the Dunlops we use, I mean, you can't even get onto the trailer without going sideways. They're that slippy. so then it's a game of trying to balance slip angle with forward motion. And there is a perfect balance. And one thing I'm very happy with is a car moving. So that's fine. But I'm so fascinated about really marginal gains and where you can... I've learned for the first time how if you get a corner right and you see a negative split on your V-box, you carry that speed gain all the way down a straight. Now, that sounds really obvious, but, you know, something I've never really considered.
Yeah.
But then when I feel that, let's say when I'm ice driving, I think, okay, if I come out of this corner straighter, then I'm going to carry that speed through. Likewise, if you get it wrong and you see a positive, you're like, you can't turn that positive into a negative halfway down the straight, so you've lost that opportunity. I think actually my perfect form of racing is everyone in the same car, like this 2-litre cup, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Same, very, very similar.
Same.
Same. And let's have a go. Now, I can't set a pole lap time, I don't think. I really need to spend more time on a racetrack, and I don't have the time. So that's a semi-frustration. But actually, just transport me into the middle of a 30-car race. Now I think that's where I might just excel, because I just think it's great. But it is a completely different discipline, and I have learned that in the last couple of years, thanks to some clients who really twisted my arm to drive their cars, which is something I've never, ever done.
Yeah. Yeah, and how much angle... Is it if I know a couple of people that race in that series. A friend of mine, Ollie Bryant, is normally
bloody brilliant. Yeah.
Up the top end.
Yeah, very much so.
And he's very clean.
Super clean.
And then occasionally you'll see some absolute hero laps from, I feel like, some Belgian dude.
Pascal Pandelar.
Yes.
He's the boy.
Yeah. Just like... just all of that angle, and seems to be reasonably quick at the same time. I'm guessing it's probably not as quick, but looks great. Where is that?
Where's the
how
line?
Much slip angle in those sorts of cars can you have and still be really fast? And also, do you need to have?
I think so. If I just briefly talk about ice driving, where I spent so many hours behind the wheel with a mate of mine and a former British champion, former World Production Cup champion, Martin Rowe. Martin drives like this, literally with his fingertips. I mean, it's staggering how smooth he is. So we spent, when I say days, I mean months together, working out how quickly we can go around an ice track. And we can drive completely differently and be plus or minus the same. And he looks at me going, I have no idea how you do that, because it's like we're going to crash on every corner. Anyone who sat with me would probably relate to that, but I haven't crashed. Whereas he's so beautiful, really, the way he drives. And I'm like, well, I don't know how you get that time. I think over a race, Ollie has his car set up in a certain way. No doubt his tyres are in better condition at the end of the race than someone who's sliding. That's a fact. So I think it's to do with two things. I think car setup is critical, and we are continuing to work on our cars. We have brilliant one lap pace. We've yet to have a driver combo that can come up and beat Ollie and Andrew. They're a brilliantly experienced guys, and I think that the series is set up with pro-ams. We don't have a pro car yet. Well, actually, that's a lie. We do have now. So it's interesting to think about, but I think you cannot drive these cars straight, but still we really want to be as straight as we can. I remember Martin Rowe, I'd spent another winter with him in Sweden, and he was criticizing my driving as he did every bloody day I spent with him. And I went to Costa Brava and I did a rally. And so I started this rally in a 911, and Martin's words ringing in my ears, right, I'm going to be a racing driver, I'm going to drive neat. And I got to the end of the first couple of stages and I was way off the pace and I was so upset. And I rang him. I said, Martin, ruin me. So we agreed on the road section whilst I was competing in Costa Brava that I was allowed a certain slip angle. And I think we got to 30%, 30 degrees, mate, 30 degrees. Anyway, in the end, I just ignored everything he told me and went back to my style. And thankfully, there was a bit of rain later in the rally and I won. But there is a combo. And even in WRC, you drivers can't drive straight because the tyres are the limitation. But no, there's a fine balance, as with everything in life. And I haven't found it on the racetrack yet, but I'm working on it.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ice driving. When did the ice driving start?
I'm awful with dates, but I'm going to say
roughly.
It's 15, 16 years old now. And the reason it started was I did Sweden in WRC, and I went out for some training with a client in Norway, and I learned so much on that rally about driving. Because talk about sliding, talk about slip angle, talk about efficiency. When everything on the ice is amplified, so you feel it 10 times more than you do on a racetrack. So firstly, amazing fun, best fun in a car. Amazingly safe, because if you have a shunt, you just hit a snowbank and you giggle, you get pulled out and you do it again. So you can really push and you can really understand the limit. Again, you can't do that anywhere else. But yeah, we're 16 years in, and now we have 8 cars for 2.5 months, and people all over the world come back and back and back. It's the repeat client stats are amazing.
Really it's, good. I've done some. And actually, 1 year, I think I messaged you and said I have an SC that's been backdated, and we were going with some friends.
You were on a road trip,
yeah, we were on a road trip, And we'd ended up booking some ice tracks as part of the thing. And we looked like maybe we'd come and stop in. But that was... those have been, we've done, I think, 3 or 4 trips now, and then probably a couple of days on the ice each trip. And it's just the most fun. It's just more fun than anything else in the world.
No, it is. And the one thing I always say at the start of that sort of question or that thought is actually just to be on a frozen lake without a car in the middle of Sweden, Finland, Norway, wherever we are, that's a huge privilege. Chuck a car at it, and I mean, it's just dreamy. We have this, so our ice driving is completely freestyle. There are no rules. It's about driving, so it's not about one of these. So many driving experiences are about whiteboards and following instructors and vans and all this.
Traction control systems and
all that. All that nonsense. Good nonsense, but nonsense nonetheless. We give you a car, and the idea is you drive it like you stole it. And we have some clients, Irish particularly, they never even come close. We have this dome on the lake, which is sort of our sort of coffee place, rest place. They never even come near the dome for fear that someone might challenge them about anything. So they literally change drivers because they share cars sometimes, change drivers on the track and carry on. They never stop for 6 hours. I mean, they barely come in for lunch. But we have amazing instructors. You know, people like Mark Duez, who's a Belgian legend. He's a guy who can drive a 911. Perhaps he drove the Bastos cars back in the day, and amazing guy. But so we've got Mark Duez stood at the lake going, "Hey, if anyone want a hand?" And these boys are like, "No, thanks, mate. We're not getting out of this car." So we have that thing. If you come to us, you've got amazing instructors who will help you. But likewise, we're very happy for you just to charge around and be hooligans. It's a very special place to be.
And do you have to do a lot of like, what cars are you running, and do you have to do a lot to them to make them fine and whatever it is?
What I should be saying is they're incredibly specialist. There's no one else in the world can build them, and so don't even try. What I'm actually going to tell you is, yes, there are rally cars. We use proper rally cars. That's one of our USPs. We use proper studded tyres, another of our USPs. But actually, what happens to an ice driving car, apart from doing staggering number of hours per season, plus the odd miss shift, plus the odd roll, all of that stuff, the surface is very kind to them. So they clog up with ice, and they get a bit heavier during the day. Overnight, they sit in an underfloor heated garage. They clean themselves. They melt. And then in the morning, we go again. So... of course, we do have some mechanical issues with the cars that we things like the cold, the humid cold is different to cold cold. So we have to make sure they work in those situations, and ultimately we chuck anyone in them. So I did have a terrible experience with a lovely lady from America who'd never driven a manual car, and her boyfriend was teaching her, and. Yeah, we had to change a clutch. So that was awful. I had no idea, but we always have a spare car, so she didn't lose any driving time. And by the end of it, she could drive a stick shift. So wasn't that a good thing?
Yeah, that's an interesting place to learn, but you know.
Why not? I wish they'd told us.
And when we've done it on in a selection of different cars. What did we do it in? Which is my 911, which I would say was the best. That was the most fun. But we were on winter tires, just like normal. Mm-hmm. And since found out that
button studs,
like we were on normal sort of continental winter tires. I've since found out that you get like Swedish winter tires that have got a different compound that are stickier, but no studs.
Did you have a button stud? No.
Okay. Which was fine. It was the most fun was back roads with snow and trees. Like that was the most fun. You felt like, well, I mean, you basically were on a rally stage, but you had grip. On the ice track, you were fine for like a couple of laps in the morning. And then it just got to the point where I'm sure you would be completely fine cruising around, but you just didn't have the grip at the back at all in the slightest.
Well, so firstly, to pick up your point, every road in Sweden, as far as you and I are concerned, is a rally stage, right? So, but the Swedes don't think that. Okay, so just be very careful. We're there thinking we're, I mean, Hannu Mikkola or Steve Blomqvist, whoever we want to be. They're just going to work. So, they're not best pleased with some of our driving at times, no doubt. Plus, they obey the law, quite rightly, I might add, but their speed limit is the same in the winter as the summer, and they have glorious roads. I've never understood it. Never get stopped for speeding in Scandinavia. It's hugely costly.
Just go in the winter. It's unlikely to happen.
So, here's the thing. So, yes, there's lots of different compounds of snow tyres. So what we call a sort of all-year-round and what we call a winter tyre here is much harder than... Because if you use a proper winter tyre here, then the rubber warms up much quicker and, of course, it becomes very, very rolly. Here's the thing. Do you know how a winter tyre works? Why it works?
Isn't it trap snow?
Yeah, snow on snow.
And then snow on snow?
So, I mean, it's bonkers. I don't really know whether I believe this, but someone's talking.
It's mad.
So the sipes grip the snow. So you've got some snow here and then they all stick to each other and it's like this. I mean, okay, whatever. But the fun thing is working on the grip levels. And one of your problems that you've just explained is what almost certainly happened is you were going round and round in the morning like legends. You were polishing the ice.
Yeah.
So next thing, you actually got no snow. You're just on ice, so your tyre doesn't work as well. So then what you have to do is you have to look, and this is where rally drivers and actually motorbike riders come into their own. You have to look at the surface and you have to know, okay, so I've got no grip here, which is fine, but I know I'm going to get grip when I get to that point.
Okay,
and
yeah, yeah.
Talking to my days, hours, months with Martin on the ice and subsequently with Ryan and anyone else who wants to go on the ice with me, we used to use just button studs. So the big stud gives you loads of grip, but actually what we use is a button stud because that's the big thing. Because if you can double guess a car, if you can really, it won't do what you want. So when it doesn't do what you want, you then make it do what it wants, then you really know what you're doing. And that's why we start our days off on a button stud because we want to give you this experience with sort of millimeters of throttle travel as to how much difference it makes. We then go on to full studs and of course then, then the crashes just get faster.
I found we had a variety of cars. So we did it in my SC one year. We had an R8 that someone Audi lent us. Great. Four-wheel drive, which actually I quite liked the four-wheel drive. That was on the same, just on winters. And that seemed to work. You could get out of a lot more stuff than that. And then we had all sorts of friends and different cars, but lots of them had small studs. And then I drove like a rage buggy that was on like full, massive, lots of studs. And that, driving around the ice, just felt kind of like tarmac. And it was four-wheel drive and you could just keep your foot in it and just go into a snowbank, come back out again.
Well, there's obviously a whole thing about snowbanks, whole thing about driving on snow, which is a very specialist thing. But someone will pick me up on this, but I think certain stages in the Swedish rally are the fastest stages in the World Rally Championship. So partly due to the nature of the roads. I mean, Finland, dangerously fast in the summer with all the jumps and everything. But Sweden, the roads are wonderful. And you have so much traction with a brand new latest WRC stud. In fact, the studs they used in the, let's say, 90s, they've now given the cars less grip. The tyres are wider and the studs are shorter and they've got less studs. Okay. But yeah, staggering levels of grip.
And then I watching, I can't remember his name, but we had a WRC driver as a coach for the day. And it was exactly the same thing as you were talking about, where everyone's just hooning around all day. And he's like, you know, do you want some help? Do you want some help? Anyone want some help? And then so I went out a little bit with him. And the thing that amazed, at the time, we were in not the car to take to Sweden, but it was great. Bentley Continental V8 convertible.
Perfect.
Why not?
Perfect.
I went out with him. And the thing that amazed me was basically the lack of inputs.
He's just literally
like a tiny, in which if you just filmed the steering wheel and the pedals, you would assume we're like doing some slight slalom down a straight road. But then you watch the video and he's like fully lit, fully sideways the entire time.
No, well, it's, I think ultimately, when you see a good driver, when you see a good tennis player, whatever it is, that everything is so well in balance that the movements are small. And, you know, if I was to take you day one round the lake, get you driving, I promise you, first thing you do is want to take your coat off. Then you'd be taking your hat off. Then you'd be taking your gloves off. You'd be out of breath. Yeah. And you'd be mentally exhausted because you're just working so, so hard. Give yourself a couple of days, then everything starts to become natural. Everything becomes in balance. So if you imagine a car, we've got accelerator, brake. So if you're left foot braking, that's another input. You've got gears, you've got steering wheel. But once you get all of that in tune, actually the steering wheel is not steering the car. I consider it like a damper for your for the inaccuracy of your throttle pedal. So if you've got too much throttle, you have to use too much steering. If you have too much steering, then you've got to start. So it becomes very, very frantic very, very quickly. But if you go in a car like anything with a good guy, be around Silverstone or a rally stage, you can drive at well over 100 miles an hour through trees and have a perfectly normal conversation with him because it just happens. No great shakes. And the person next to you is going absolutely beside themselves because they can't imagine how they're going to get around the next corner. It's great. It's really good.
And how much progress do you see in people over, I think, I don't know how long do people normally come for a day, but
two days is perfect, but the improvement is staggering. So 2 days on the ice track is worth 10 or 20 days on a racetrack because you have the freedom to make mistakes and you have an environment which amplifies, as I was saying, all the good things and all the bad things. So you learn so quickly. This isn't a sales pitch. It's game changing. And we have race drivers. We have young race drivers, young rally drivers. And then lovely ladies from America who've never driven a stick shift. We have everyone.
Yeah. And I guess because if you go to, let's say, a track day, test day, any of that stuff, you're not allowed to slide the car. It can be, you know, on the edge, but you're not allowed to be just like hucking it in. So, and how often do people make a mistake on a circuit? Not that often, like a big one where you're going to require a massive correction. So to build up time in the over the limit category, just doesn't happen.
No, there's no greater place. Mind you, the track day boys and test day, they are getting used to us turning up in 2 liter 911s that sit at extraordinary angles. And you overtake a GT3 somewhere probably you shouldn't, sideways, and the GT3 owner is looking at you going, what's that all about? And then he obviously comes straight past you on the straight. Yeah. But actually, you know, the other thing is if you take a GT3 to Silverstone, you've got to be a brave guy to unstick that car, because to unstick a GT3 or anything of that magnitude is a big moment in your life. And if it goes wrong, it's going to be a problem. It's going to be a huge problem. So I don't blame them, but I do like going past them sideways in a 2 liter car from 1965.
Well, that's the age old thing of like the funnest car to be in on a track day is, well, one, if you're going sideways, but also something that looks slow and is, you know, on paper is slow going past other cars that are on paper fast. That there's no greater thing on a track day to be in something that's slow going past faster cars.
It's great. And as I say, I don't blame these guys in these quick cars. They're terrifying. So I get it. And then if I could just touch briefly on this thing about a 911, and I'm going to include the current ones, not that I've driven many lately, but they are mentally more stimulating than any other car. So if we had a BMW on an ice track or a circuit, you and I would both think we're legends within 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Front engine, loads of turning, rear that'll do whatever you want it to do and get you out of jail a million times. A 911 asks you a question. It asks you a different question every corner you go into it. And once you can answer that question, it's just such a challenge. And it remains a challenge every time you drive them. And at the end of the day, that's what keeps you engaged. And I don't know of another car that does that. So, and it's nothing to do with our cars, nothing to do with anything we've done or anyone's done. It's just 9/11. I mean, it's the best thing that ever happened to road cars, clearly.
Yeah, a fundamentally flawed formula. But because of that, the driving characteristics are really interesting. Like it, I was amazed at how quickly I could go in my SC in the snow relative to modern stuff on studs. Like when you've got the grip, you've got grip and you are going. When you're in that middle phase, you have to make the right decision.
A bit of patience. And I haven't driven one of these latest GT3s with the double wishbone front suspension. I've driven the Singer DLS, which got the same system. There's this moment in a 911. So if I can give one piece of advice to anyone driving a 911, you need to be quite positive, aggressive in the first phase, which is the braking phase, to get this weight over the front. You always have to be patient in the middle. So the second third of the corner, you just have to wait. And that's a waiting phase whilst everything sorts itself out in the world. And then as soon as you've got the feeling back again, it's aggression. So it's always, or positivity, aggression. I must be very careful because my driving is a bit aggressive, but it's positive, passive, positive. Every corner, once you've unlocked that, you're all over it. But it's very, very special. And it's ironic. Yes, in theory, it's a flawed design, but don't forget, you've got traction, you've got independent suspension, you've got big engines. And how on earth they have continued to keep the 911 where it is. I can't imagine what they've got up their sleeve that they just are not releasing, because if they release it all on day one, then you have to work bloody hard to make it better next time. But they're a clever bunch.
Yeah.
They're a clever bunch.
Yeah, it's pretty mad. Although we're starting to see Porsche with the Caymans just do the, you know what, they're going to go electric. Let's just go for it. Let's just put the GT3 engine in. Let's make it mad.
I was speaking to someone about it yesterday. I mean, I think we must always have discussed, for example, why the first Cayman GT4 didn't have it had a really long ratio gearbox, all of these little things. It must have been, I can only assume, to keep, well, probably emissions, and also keep it underperforming versus a 911.
Yeah.
But it's a fascinating thing. And I'm sure they'll protect their Halo car, and so they should. It's amazing.
Yeah, that one thing, the gearbox, in all, definitely Porsches at the moment, pretty much, whether it's a GT3 or a Cayman, if you put a shorter gearbox in it, those cars would become significantly more interesting and frantic than, especially the Caymans. The Caymans, you get in and you're like, okay, come on. Like,
yeah.
The engine just feels slow.
Yeah, well, there's a reason, I'm sure.
Yeah, but then people are doing it.
There's
who is it?
I saw this morning, Chris has just driven some electric four-wheel drive Cayman.
Yes. So there was a concept car, which was the Mission R.
Awesome, yeah.
And then there's now the GT4E performance or something, I think, that Chris drove. It was basically it's kind of like a cup car, but with 600 horsepower or 1,000 horsepower four-wheel drive.
Staggering. And then okay, we're now digressing, but why not? Do you see the thing that Ken Block released this morning, the four-wheel drive Pikes Peak car?
I don't know anything about it. I just saw George's picture of it.
Pink thing.
It looks like some sort of 964 GT2 or something. Well,
I'm on a group with Chris and a few other boys, so I pinged it to them, and they were all being asleep. I'm an early riser. and of course, everyone's got a view. My view is unbelievable. It's just cool. And having worked with Ken, I text him straight away. Come on, I want to know all about this. How can I I actually said to him, can I make an off-road version, obviously. So that's going to be, that's mid-engine by the look of it, 1,000 or 1,400 horsepower. I mean, I was lucky enough, I went in his Hoonigan and he drove me round a demo lap in Saudi in November. And I never can't even imagine what that thing could do, and sat next to him, staggering. And so this car he's doing for Pikes Peak looks like a tubular thing. So it's got some poor shapes, but I'm sure that's about it. Probably just his Mustang turned around underneath.
But see, that his projects, if you'd asked, when I first came across Ken Block, I was like, seems like a pretty cool dude, doing some skids and stuff. And then over the last, I don't know, 6-7 years, he's just done cooler and cooler things. Tapped into a lot of history as well.
He's clearly a car guy, firstly. So he hasn't just sort of invented all of this. He's clearly incredibly clever, really switched on, knows what's cool and what's not. He's got a great team around him. And having, you know, spent 3 weeks with him in Africa, he's an absolute gentleman. He's a bloody good driver. And he now has a fan base, a following, an ability to do cool stuff. But yeah, I was pretty sure. I knew about this project. I didn't know any detail. I hadn't seen a pitch. I didn't know, but I knew it was underway before we'd met. I knew it's been something that they've been working on for a long time. So pleased for him to people doing something like this. And I think it's just good for us all. It's a good looking thing.
Yeah. How did his sort of collaboration, it's probably the right word ish, with you guys come about? How did he find you guys?
Oh, genius. Years of strategy and marketing and planning and at the very highest level of the company. But was it that just his co-driver rang Andy Brown, who now heads up our motorsport, and said, "Hey, Andy, Ken would like to do Safari. I see you're working with Richard. Is it possible?" So I was asked the question. Of course, I just said yes. I got an email from a guy called Travis Clark, who I hadn't heard from since 2008 when I did Baja with Travis. And he was managing Travis Pastrana. He now manages Ken Block. We didn't sign a contract. I spoke to Travis three times and I said, "Yeah, we're doing it." And they said, "Great." And that was it. It's hugely uncommercial, super relaxed, all on trust. Seems like a good idea. Let's do it. And we did it. And the guys at Monster came to the workshop, launched the car, which sort of never got launched because of COVID and all that good stuff. But just one of those things, again, don't think too hard about life. Just get on and do it. It was bound to be cool. And I just had to find a way to do it. And I'm pleased we did, because it was again, one of life's great experiences with a cool guy.
It was cool. I didn't even know it was happening at all. And then I came to, the only time I've come to visit you guys, his car was in the entrance hall. And I was like, "Hang on a minute, says Ken Block. It's like an old 911. What's going on here?"
Well, we're not brilliant at telling people about everything. And Laura the reason we're chatting is because Laura's keen to introduce us to a few more people and just generally share what we get up to a bit more. But so that is a thing. But yeah, in the past, and really still, we're semi-well kept secret.
So doing fun stuff in old cars. Building a Safari car, what do you have to do? And then also, I want to take this into like projects, because you do so many projects that are interesting. A Safari car, what car can you take on the Safari in that sort of category?
It's typically governed by the cutoff date. And of course, I ought to know, but they don't allow four-wheel drive. They don't allow turbocharged. So 911 wise, actually from 73 on, there's not a great deal you can or can't do to 911. So the body shape changes, and there's a few things, but within the Safari regs, none of it really matters because it's sort of lumped in as one. But ironically, they're not that specialist. We went through a phase where they were quite specialist in terms of the body shell. We learned all about body shells looking after pro drive cars in sort of 86, 87 in the Middle East. The advent of a four-way adjustable damper with a hydraulic bump stop means that the car's very well protected. So The cars aren't heavy. They're not overly heavy. They could be lighter, actually. We build a car that is going to survive. And actually, the specialist parts, dampers, brakes, bit of rhubarb action, some roof ends. Other than that, take all that off, or not even take it off. Go to Silverstone the day after it comes back from Kenya, put a high ratio gearbox and have a go. In fact, we have done a few days in safari cars at Silverstone, but they're it's a very, very, our cars in general, be it a road car, a 65 2-litre cup car, or a safari car, there's a DNA that runs through them. It's all the same. Same loom, same fuel system, same throttle system, same everything, because it works. It's taken us a very, very long time to get to this position. It's either on display or it's not on display. It's covered in leather, it's not covered in leather, all sorts of stuff.
But the stuff underneath, yeah, is all very similar. Because you build quite a lot of cars for customers as a road car or as a race car or as a rally car, etc. And what's your favourite? If you were to build a road car that, I'm going to go two ways. One, let's start with something that's quasi-production-esque, not just mad, because I know there's some mad stuff going on.
Okay, so firstly, there's not one, obviously one car that's not going to do it, because you need lots. This is going to be a bit frustrating, but come up this afternoon, and I'll show you the latest bit of madness that's going on, which is
a gold car.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's cool. It could be pretty extreme. I mean, how usable in terms of let's go on a road trip to the south of France. Is it? Not sure. Don't care. It's not the point. So, through to another new project, which is that car, which I want to jump in and go to the south of France in. But I want an element of just the other stuff that we like in cars. So I'm being very vague here, but look, I think you've got to have a car that you can jump in and just absolutely blow your mind, and then you've got to have a car that you can do some distance in. I think that where we all struggle, and by we I mean everyone who builds, rebuilds an old car, is that balance between usability, comfort, excitement, all of that stuff. And it's quite difficult to find. My association with Senger and being amazed at the cars they build and produce, even for them, it's a challenge to get that balance absolutely where we want it. But it depends that the point is the discussion we have with the client, because we build cars for clients, bespoke cars, is what's the use? And let's try and nail that use, because I've sort of given up trying to make a 1973 car faster than the GT3, because it's a ridiculous concept anyway. And if you've got a GT3, well, let's not make it. You need a different car. If I come back to pure form of driving, I always end up at a 2-litre short wheelbase car. The driving we can do on the roads these days is what we have to respect everything. So I want to feel like I'm doing 140 miles an hour at 40 miles an hour. I want to work for that enjoyment. I don't want too much power, because then I'm in trouble before I have to finish. The point is, we're having a lot of fun doing some really cool cars, and thankfully there's great people out there who inspire us and ask us to do some stuff. But the next couple of projects, Gold One being one of them, I think that will move us into a slightly different position in terms of what people think of us. Because we are still at heart known for safari and adventure stuff.
Yeah, and sort of 60s-esque 911s.
Yeah.
So that if I from the outside in, and then we've had things like the Singer project.
Yeah.
Or project.
That was cool.
Yeah, I mean, sure, that's pretty mad.
Yeah, it'll pretty sure it'll get madder. So again, that was that from my perspective, if you asked me to do the ultimate car that I could ever be asked to do, that was it. We there's some sort of complications that are fairly well known, I know it's got another life, and it will return in some form. But if I never built another one, I just was so privileged to be asked. The collaboration with Rob and his team was brilliant. I mean, really brilliant. Maybe unlikely, actually, from the outside. And it led to other things. And they're a great bunch of guys, good friends. And we produced a car that there won't be many cars like that in the world ever built again. And I'm really proud that we were involved.
And what was the... what's the story? What's the use case of the customer that goes, I want you to build a car? What, how did that one sort of come about? And then how did you approach it?
With reference to the singer rally
the
car.
Singer.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, car, yeah. The client, who's clearly ahead of the curve a bit, he dropped some cars off in Singer's yard, literally. I think they rang him out and said, what are these? Oh, I'd like a rally car. Oh, okay. We don't do that. Oh. But we know someone who did. Or do we know someone who can? And we had a chat, got on the phone, and I went over and saw them. And it started off, as often things in life do, really, okay, well, chuck some suspension on it, a couple of wheels, you know, raise the ride height. And what we ended up with 4 years later was just beyond what we ever imagined. So most bizarre, an amazing guy behind it who just said, yeah, go on, crack on. Fill your boots, do what you can. A brilliant creative team in LA, and our mechanical knowledge updated and with no regulations, which is the great thing. They wouldn't. If you want to go to Baja, you just look at the regulations. I mean, you might as well look at a blank page. It's literally build yourself a car and let's go nice. To Baja. So that was the brief. Ironically, because of COVID, no one from Singer saw the car from the minute we started it to the minute we finished it. And the first time Rob saw it was when it was covered in mud in the middle of a Welsh forest. And Rob's bloody marvellous, but one thing he loves more than anything else is door gaps and trim. And that's like, there you go, Rob. See how you get with that one. It's covered in mud. But it was wonderful. Really, really special. An amazing thing to have done. Really amazing.
It was a really cool... It was there when I came in, and it to imagine something like that coming out of what I'd known about you guys beforehand. I mean, it's such a sort of modern looking, serious. I know there's a lot that are very serious, but it just looks so different to things I've seen before come out of Tuthill.
You think what that tells you is, and we've learned in. No shame in admitting that my learning whilst working with them has been massive. And we've always been known for producing brilliant mechanical cars. And I can understand the criticism about sometimes the way the cars have been presented. And I'm talking a long time ago now. You know, when we did Chris and I did that ST, yeah, I don't know how many years ago. But if that's wheeled into the building now, it's still owned by a good client. It's just nowhere near what we build today. It's just not acceptable. And the world has moved on. And I'd actually say we've got to be very careful here. The world's moved on a little bit too far, where we are so critical about everything that I think at a certain point you these cars are, and I think this is our... really one of our USPs. We use our cars. So let's not go too far where we just, a car is never good enough. So get out, enjoy them. You can repair them. Let's not overthink it too much. Build something that you want and go and bloody use it. Because otherwise just another thing to put in your garage. And if my garage is anything to go by, which by the way, it's got no cars in it, everyone's got plenty of stuff to put in their garages, and most of it shouldn't be in there, and nor should your car. It should be on the road, and you should be driving it.
That's an interesting sort of point, because I, with all these sort of the various resto mods and sort of high-end builds, the first thing I've definitely got to the point where I critique them on stuff that, like, it's kind of pointless. Like, it doesn't matter. things I'm like, oh, but that then blah 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 blah. And like, yeah, but like, yeah. Certain things to fix or to do right. And we see these, I mean, some of these builds are so expensive and so much money goes into making small details really nice. And you know, creating something to then go in an old car that none of them are the same. Nothing's ever going to fit right. To make it all look really good costs so much money. And we see the builds. You could get a build that's, let's say, just a 100 grand build, a 200 grand build, and then like an 800 grand build. And to go from the 200 to like the next level, you just, it just the money just goes like.
So on the basis of your maths, to go from 2 to 8 should cost 6. It costs about a million. So that's the thing. These cars are so lovely. They're becoming a bit more like art than a car. And I love them. And we aspire and are producing now. The next couple of projects we're doing will be another level. But I still want to come back to the fact that we must enjoy driving them. And our target client is that guy or girl. It's and that's something that, again, we're my new sort of concept going forward is sticking to what we've always done. Build cars, but then we're going to give you lots of excuses to use them. Because actually what we all like doing, just like you mentioned earlier with your trips to Scandinavia and your road trips, you've got a lovely car, now you need some mates, and now you need to go somewhere. Because there's only so many times you can go to the pub and back in it. So if we can generate reasons to use cars, then we'll all be better off for it. And it's a crazy thing if you look at safari cars. They are now way, way more beautiful than they ever were. They're still the same speed. They do everything. We then go to Kenya, we smash them up a bit, and then we rebuild them, and then we do it all over again. I mean, genius business model, granted. someone a long time ago really worked that out. But the point is, we're producing showroom standard cars to put in a container and then go and drive 5,000 kilometers around Africa.
Yeah.
And we need to continue to do that because it's about experiences and it's about doing things with great people with great cars.
Yeah, and your point about, and I think the customers find you because that is sort of generally the situation with a lot of your cars. I'm sure you've got customers that do all sorts, some that do absolutely none with their cars, but the ones I've met are all about driving and using their cars. And I think each person, something I've talked about before, but each person has their level of car or cars that they can afford. And you might go, I could really stretch myself and get this car up here. But in reality, if I do that, I can't afford, I can't really afford to use it. And I've done that. And then
it becomes a bit precious.
I've now realized
the car becomes a bit precious at that point.
It does. It becomes precious. I had an F40 for a bit.
Yeah, I know.
For 5 years.
That's the thing.
And it was great. It was awesome. But the reality was I didn't drive it that much. Mileage is like a killer in those cars. You could go, yeah, you could drive it forever and it's not going to depreciate. Okay, yeah, fine. But still, if the paint's in great condition, and mine was a stupid color, then you don't want to get it resprayed and all that sort of blah, 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 blah. It just got to the point where I didn't use it.
Yeah.
So I realized I would way rather have either a couple or one car that is a bit like the sort of value of my SC or something like that, where I'm happy to take it to Sweden and wang it around. And if something gets damaged, it's not actually that expensive to repair it unless you fully, you know, go big style into something. And I get so much more enjoyment out of the using. And I need to remember that and do more using. Just do more things, not just put it around.
And I think one of the things I caught onto pretty early on, and again, I can reference Safari again, was we've been very successful with Safari, both in the terms of we've won it more than anyone else, but actually what's more important to me is we've taken more people to Africa. We've had more clients than anyone else, which means we've been able to have more fun. And I very early on worked out that we could be in Africa, hot air ballooning, mountain biking, doing whatever. But what the car allows us to do is go somewhere with great people and see great things. And it just gives you sort of entry into something. And I think ownership of things in life is great, but actually what is way greater is having had experiences that we can all look back on, because at the end of the day, they're the things we'll really remember. So the ice driving has highlighted that, and it's something that I believe where we're heading with all things automotive is that we've got to be looking at special occasions with special cars doing special things, and I think that's certainly where we're on the way to, and making it more available.
Mm. And that, because if you said to me, you know, you can only do, and I think a lot of people end up in this situation time wise or whatever, they're like, you've got 5 weekends or 2 weekends to do like whatever you like. The other ones you've got, either you've got no time or you're going on holiday or you're doing other stuff.
Got to go to a christening.
Got to go to a christening. Whoopity-do. So, you know, what are you going to do in those 2 weekends? And you're like, well, I want to do something memorable and have a lot of fun. What is that? And, you know, what does that look like?
Yeah.
With the Africa stuff, I feel like, what do the logistics look like of putting on and supporting cars ragging across Africa?
It looked like the biggest Excel spreadsheet you've ever seen. That's what it looks like. And actually, okay, you've got to come up this afternoon and have a look at that golf thing. Then come up on Friday and see 13 safari cars come back from Africa. That's what logistics looks like. Just a world of, oh my God, really? No, listen, it's like everything. The first time you do it, it's a thing. And then over the time you evolve it to become less of a thing, then it volumes up and you find different problems. Now, the challenge we always face is we don't know the route, can't predict the weather. And every day in Africa is an opportunity for chaos. Every day of my life is an opportunity for chaos, but that's my problem. So you're dealing with a whole load of things that you can't control. So you have to be incredibly light-footed. And I'm gonna say that I'm right up there in terms of the best people to be agile. Because what I love more than anything else is we're driving along in our management truck, in our own event, which, by the way, is way more competitive than the rally. That's properly competitive. And something happens, and then there's me, Andrew, who's my ops guy next to me, Graham, the engineer in the back, and then usually some other poor person who's just been chucked in the back of our truck. But then you've got to go, okay, what's happening? We've got X number of cars. We're 200 Ks away, 50 Ks away. What's happening that night? Where are the vans? All of this stuff. And you've got to make a decision extremely quickly, and you've got to make the right decision. And that's really, really good fun. We help ourselves because all the cars are the same. So whatever truck I send, we know it'll have the right bits, and that's critical. But it's that moment where you go, okay, come on, we're in the shit here. How are we going to fix it? And it's addictive. So the logistics of how to make that happen. The starting point for all of this is brilliant people, absolutely brilliant people who will do whatever it takes to get stuff done. And thankfully, we're surrounded by loads of them. And one of the nicest thing is that every morning I walk into a workshop with brilliant people who work incredibly hard, love what they do, and get stuck in. And honestly, we've just done a documentary on our last safari rally, which will be released shortly. And I say it over and over again in the film, people are just doing amazing things. And it's just, it's awe-inspiring. So once you've got good people, and then you've got some really clever people who can think extremely clearly and coordinate, then you're halfway there. But we streamlined it a long time ago, and it's not as daunting as it once was.
Mm.
Big job there.
And I guess each time you do it and stuff goes right, stuff goes wrong, you're like, well, we've learned all that. Next time around, we take it up another notch.
Absolutely. That's the score.
Are you one of the biggest groups out there?
In the rally?
Mm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no one's ever run more than 4 cars, I think, apart from us. But we get actually, it's lovely going and chasing Kenyans around Africa, because it's a sort of love-hate, love relationship. I don't know. I'm not sure all the time. And a lot of people say, you know, you're this massive team. This is ridiculous. Firstly, we're just on a whole bunch of guys working in Waddington. Point one. Point two, per car, we have less people on the event than anyone else. We have a lot of cars. There's a lot of people. But the regulations state how many people you can have and how many vehicles you can have. And it's got out of shape. Last year, it was crazy. You allowed 3 service vehicles. And so every service vehicle, you can't send a dude across Africa on his own. So that's 2 people.
Yeah.
And then you can have management cars and all sorts of nonsense. We don't do any of that. We have less cars and less people per car than any other team in there. But okay, we, because of the way we run it, we do have an opportunity to do that. But yeah, there's a big crowd of us, and it's living with people you work with for a month in Africa is wonderful. It's a wonderful experience. Honestly, it's genuinely wonderful. I mean, you have your moments, but it's brilliant. Yeah, yeah. And then you come back to 9 to 5, if that's what we can call it. But you've been through really good stuff together, and it helps. It's great.
Does a large chunk of the team from base get involved, and do you sort of try and like swap people out so everyone gets a chance to go at some point, or is it the same people hardcore? They know their stuff.
No, I'm really aware that essentially, if someone in the building wants to go to Africa, it's my job to facilitate that. Even John the Body, he runs our body shop. He's worked for us for, I don't know, 25 years or something. Even he said he wants to come. Now, we don't do a lot of spraying out in Africa. But if he's still fit next year, I've got to take him. I owe it to him. But no, the building sort of empties. There's some admin guys who come and don't come. Of course, we leave a core staff behind. But it's I don't know what they do. I'm sure they don't really work when we're not there. Can't do. But no, we try and anyone who wants to come, I've got to make it happen, because it's important.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then presumably, okay, there's a lot of logistics of taking more cars, more stuff. But if you've got, let's say you've taken whatever it is, 10, 14 cars or something, you've got spares for all of them and people that can work on all of them, but hopefully not all of them break down at once. So actually you've got is there a limit to number of people that can work on a car at once?
There's a regulation that stipulates you can only have 3 people at any one time on any car. So what we do, our limiting factor is people, because not everyone can survive Africa. Not everyone can cope with it. It's bloody hard work. Plus, not everyone can actually change your rear arm on the side of a road. even I had to change a front right strut on the side of the road. And actually, honestly, one of the highlights of the whole event, I was absolutely up to my neck in it. And I just happened to be the first guy on the scene. So I dived in, because it's been a while, but I really enjoyed it. But people is our limiting factor. So actually what I'm trying to work out for the next rally, which is only 18 months away, I'm going to mix it up again, and I'm going to look at how we service, because as I say, the limit is having that knowledge, because you have to have enormous amount of knowledge. And when you're spreading yourself across cars, which are running, let's say, 2.5 hours apart, unless I can convince them that I have to have a helicopter to travel in, I can't be everywhere. And of course, it's not all about me, so I've got some great guys, but we split ourselves up across the 13 cars. But yeah, people's limiting factor in how many cars we can run.
Something, you know, as I've done some racing and various stuff, and a lot of the other drivers that I know well, a lot of them haven't got a clue about mechanical stuff. Like, I would say a decent percentage of racing drivers I know couldn't work on the cars. But a lot of them are interested in doing it. But then it's a case of like, it's almost the gateway is too high at that point. You need to, everyone has to regress so much to just like start on it. Do the drivers and stuff, any of them just get, say, can I come and work on a car for a couple of days or something?
Well, they do actually. And yesterday, a really nice German guy called Tobias Koenig, he turned up, and I'll be honest, I didn't know he was coming. I didn't have to know he was coming. But he spent 8 hours in the workshop yesterday. And because he's doing a long rally, which we don't support, we're not allowed to support, and we're on the end of the phone, everyone's got a visa so we can charge out to wherever he is in the world. He spent 8 hours going through his car, and it's not uncommon. And look, we lost the Safari Rally this year, and I say lost. We weren't beaten. We lost the rally ourselves because we had a problem with the drive shaft. Patrick Sandell was pretty much in control of everything. And they had a drive shaft problem. The drive shaft problem was, I'm very honest about this, was caused by a rebuild error in our workshop. But his co-driver, who'd never done a rally, but is an engineer, Henrik, changed the drive shaft in 20 minutes on the during a competitive section. So the clock was ticking. And I promise you, it's hard to change your drive shaft in 20 minutes in a workshop. So yes, it bloody helps if you spend a bit of time on the car. So hats off to him. I'm pretty sure I couldn't have done it any quicker.
Yeah, fair play.
So no, I'm not about to launch an intro to mechanicking course, but buy a car and you can come and spend a day with us. How's that?
Yeah. Fair enough. And then with sort of the future of Tata. But it's sort of moving forward on stuff you've done, and then you've got all these builds that you can't tell anyone about until they're done.
No.
So no one knows about them. Are there any plans to do this is a Tuttle something?
Yes. I mean, the thing is, we've always grown organically, and the world/Instagram is full of renders, and it's full of the new greatest thing. And I watch from afar, and I've been following Ken because why not? He's become someone I did something cool with. But if I looked at Instagram for too long, I'd sort of work out that we're not good enough. So let's go and do something else. Someone needs to convince me. And I have got an absolute game changer of a plan. So I'm going to revolutionize what we all think is this market. So just stand by, but it's coming. We don't really shout too much about what we do. And I actually like to. So this gold car, how good is it going to be? Amazing. I hope.
Sounds good.
But am I going to tell the world and produce a render and go, this is going to be amazing? And the reality is, what I want to do is feel it for myself and go, yeah, okay, really is amazing. And that has strengths and weaknesses, is pros and cons from a business perspective. We've got a new shed that's nearly finished, same as the current one. So the floor's going down in a couple of weeks.
Quite a big shed then. It's quite a big shed.
Another big shed. Love a shed. And that's going to give us an opportunity to, give us a bit more room. I mean, we only moved into that one 3 years ago, and I looked at it when I moved, and I thought, well, this is way too big. So that gives us an opportunity, and that opportunity, I'm working very, very hard to do something. And so that could then lead to us saying, actually, here's something. But as I alluded to earlier, my what I really want to continue to do, and in fact, do a lot more of, is, so you might not want to do the Safari Rally. Oh, actually, sorry, let me rephrase that. You're bound to want to do the Safari Rally, but it might be, for whatever reason, you don't want to compete. You haven't got the time. I don't know what the reason could be. There is no reason why you wouldn't want to do it. But actually, I'd love to take you to Africa in a different form to experience what we do, maybe not such a intense level. I want to share some of the stuff we've done. And if that's through driving experiences, which are different. I mean, we launched our own rally a couple of years ago, which we didn't run because of COVID. It was called Rally with No Name because I couldn't think of a name.
And no date.
But it had a date. It had a full entry list. It had an entry list of 20 cars, 20 of my cars, 20 of my favorite clients. And again, I want to look at rallying or let's say events. They've always been done how they've always been done. Why? Mm. Why should we go rallying like we did in the 1970s? So I'm looking at all of this stuff and the next 6 months is probably quite an interesting time. And I just want to have another go, roll the dice again.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to as and when whatever these finished, stamped, ready to go things just suddenly appear.
Imagine. They'll be real though. There won't be a render in sight. They'll be real.
Yeah. Oh, that'll be cool. That'll be very cool. Right. Well, I normally wrap these up with 5 questions.
Hmm.
You ready? Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
Yeah. I picked up a 356 Roadster in Nice. I drove with my wife. I think she was my wife then. She is now. We drove from there to the north of Spain, where I tested a safari car at Chateau Lestor. Amazing test ground. And then we drove home. I fell in love with Roadsters, and I now own one, and it's probably the only car I really ever want to own. 356 Roadster.
Nice.
Easy answer.
That is a great way of doing a trip, because like there's a lot of, you've got to, like you were saying earlier, you've got to pick your compromise in a car.
55 miles an hour. 55 miles an hour. Roof down. Everything overtakes you. I mean, you can go 90 miles an hour, but why would you? Everything can overtake you, so there's no rush.
And then a rally stage with a rally car.
Yeah, there was a rally car in the middle of it, obviously, in a vineyard. So you had wine during the lunch break.
Nice.
Properly French.
That is strong. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life, and you're allowed a £500 something else on the side, basically allows you something slightly practical that's going to be crap on the side, and then you get one car.
So the crap thing is probably the car I drive every day, my Golf GTD. So, so I've got that, 2011. Yeah. One car, it's definitely a Porsche. It's either a 2 litre car, or it could even be a 912. Ooh. Yeah.
Interesting.
I'd say 912.
Okay. Why 912?
It's ruined my business model, hasn't it? The four-cylinder engine's got a funny torque. And on the assumption that it's forever, and we're not going to be able to drive fast forever, I'll just tool around in that. And then when you're not looking, I'll chuck a 6-cylinder engine in the back of it, because you'll never know. That'll do. Something like that.
And then occasionally raise it up.
Yeah, give it some height so we can get over some bumps, yeah.
What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment? What should be worth more? And don't say 65 911s.
No, I wish I could, because that would help. But funny enough, I don't really follow... because we don't retail stuff, I don't follow pricing. Is anything undervalued now?
I mean, right now, I feel like that is a really difficult question, because I think everything is borderline.
So the only thing...
Some stuff not.
The only thing I ought to say, and I've done it twice in the last year, is I've taken a picture of a certain car that's in our workshop, and I always send stuff to Chris, because I've got no one else to send anything to. 993... RS or RS Club Sport.
Yeah.
The best 911 they ever made. Is that
interesting?
Underpowered. So always it's underpowered. There's a lightness to the gear change and the controls and the doors are light and it's underpowered. Great car. And I don't know whether they're undervalued because they're expensive. Everything's expensive. But yeah, really awesome car.
The 993s, are an interesting one. Because I've never driven a 993. But I think partly because everyone has done a 964.
Apart from us.
So
him.
So 993 is like the next one over, and it's the last air cooled and all that sort of stuff. And they're starting to come into their looks a bit. I think they're really cool now. Is that the sort of generation? But then you run into this thing that you've alluded to earlier. I've got the sort of bookends of 911, not quite, and I think I need to bookend it a bit more. I need to move one of them sideways. I've got a 997 GT3 RS, yep. Gen 2, which on the road is too much, but it is quite. It's still fun and it's still engaging, and it's got a manual. I think once you go past that point, and I do quite like, I like the more modern stuff, and I've driven the new GT3. I feel like they're kind of, you really do need to take them on track. They need to definitely spend some time on track to, you know, if you're going to start chucking them around a little bit, you've got to do that somewhere with some space. Yeah. And then I'm like, well, I have my SC, but it's that bit of, do I need to go older and less grippy and just be like, I've got something that's super old and drive it quite slowly or relatively slowly with not a lot of grip, and then I've got the two kind of ends of the equation, and then use that for tooling around and having fun in? Or where do you pick the point in the middle of all of these things if you're only going to have one? It's like,
yeah, but
it's a difficult equation. That
just bump straight back to the point. I mean, you just need to buy more so you can, yes, you need an early car,
that's it.
Yes, you need late. The 993. Yeah, that's the thing. Watch this space. There's eight in the workshop at the moment. They're no longer what they were, which at times has felt...
They're not having a service.
Times has felt a bit criminal, honestly. So that's the thing. That's a live thing. And then, so I've owned two 993s. One was that I bought from a mate from uni, which I should never have sold because it was just a narrow body cool thing. And then a customer bought in, actually the same guy who owns a 993 RS, he bought in a C2S. And just on looks alone, I think that's a really good looking car. I couldn't find one, so I bought a C4S, which ultimately a bit disappointing because it didn't handle the same. But yeah, 993s are great, really. And so I've always questioned, why has everyone started with 964s?
Well, yes.
And then put everything from the 993 on the 964. The 964, don't forget, was an intermediary car. So if you drive the latest, the last 993 with, I don't know, how many years of evolution? 11 or something? I don't know. It was a pretty good car, an amazing car, really very practical, everything. I mean, maybe they're a bit dull, but nothing we can't fix.
You can always spice up.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an interesting one. And I'm looking forward to seeing some of these things appear.
Undervalued, maybe 993 RS or Top Sport, because I think it's an extraordinary car.
Cool. Most interesting car to you at the moment? What are you Googling, looking up?
Well, obviously the gold thing we talked about is driving me crazy because I'm enjoying being in the middle of a mental project. In terms of what's going on in the world, but I sort of quite like this electric stuff in a sense, because I like quiet stuff. Like, don't like noise, which is ironic given what I do. So I don't know whether I can. I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Well, this morning it was the Ken Block car.
Well, let's say that then, because tomorrow will be something else. So let's say that.
Yeah. Fair enough.
But that. I don't think there's much Porsche in it, which is a worry. I need to find out. But let's just say that, because I saw it this morning and I've got the attention span of a nuke. So by tomorrow, it'll be different.
Yeah, fair enough. Right. Five-car garage. Unlimited value.
Okay. So Roadster 912. Short quattro. Drove one back from the pub when I was young. I was legal, but to be driving a short quattro was a stupid idea. But I'm sensible, so that was okay. So short quattro, that's, so I've got two more. The Porsche
RS2.
No. Okay. Well, remember that line. No, the Taycan Cross Turismo thing that that they took to the Top Gear boys took it to Sweet Lamb. That's a cool thing. So one of them, don't know whether it's electric or not, but something like that. And then
is electric. Yeah.
And then yes, the Porsche made those vans, square type two van, which was done by Porsche with big brakes. Sort of, what's that? Do you know it? You're looking really blank.
A van?
Yes. They put a load of Porsche stuff. It was an official product into... Can you Google?
Picking up Porsche van. What on earth is this? Hang on a minute.
It's a type... You know, it's a bloody square van. Had a Porsche 3.2 in it. Late 70s, early 80s. One of them. So I've got a van. So we've got a van and a state car. I didn't say 993 RS. And I've just said it's the best car in the world.
But you did.
There we are. I'm done. I'm committed.
You've got to draw the line at least for this minute.
Yes. Okay.
And then onwards. Cool. Well, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
It's all right. I think we got that. The audience will know nothing about it.
Okay, there was no interruption, so all good.
Yeah.
Thank you very, very much. Nice to chat.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.